In the beginning, Ibiza's ancient wells were sacred places of fertility, life and renewal, temples to the moon goddess Tanit. But slowly the people started forgetting, and the more they worshipped the god of the sun, the more the wells began to dry. You're listening to The Wells of Tanit, a podcast celebrating the folklore, mythology, history and ecology of the island of Ibiza. My name is Joanna Ruby. I'm an artist and puppeteer and the founder of Theatre of the Ancients, and we're about to journey together to one of Ibiza's wells to see what stories it has to tell us. Don't be afraid, take my hand, and let's go and find the Wells of Tanit. There's not a soul around. I'm in a strange, long, narrow strip, which is a kind of an orchard, and it's filled with pomegranate trees, and the pomegranates are definitely ready to be picked. Some of them are splitting and going rotten, and I'm really wondering whether somebody needs to pick those pomegranates. I've got my back against a stone wall. There's a bramble gently saying hello there as well. I'm sat on the ground and there's long grass surrounding me, which is very unusual. I could almost be on Dartmoor in Devon in England. To my right there's a semicircular platform which is also covered in grass, lush and green, and it's got a stone rim around the edge of it, and I wonder whether at one point, or whether it's still a platform for dancing the bal payés. And just slightly to my left and in full view is the Po de Beni Musa, which is this big, hulking, kind of square-shaped, honey-coloured stone well. It's kind of chunky. And it's got a kind of a wooden roof on the inside of the chamber. And inside the chamber, there's the most amazing mechanism for hauling up the buckets of water, made out of a huge trunk of wood and with a kind of cog mechanism made out of another huge rounded piece of wood. It's a beautiful piece of art. The well has got brambles hanging over the front of it, and it's surrounded by these lovely lush grasses. And off to the right, just to the right hand side of the well, is the most incredible water trough that I think I've ever seen. Most of Ibiza's wells have these vessels next to them, which I've been told were for the animals. If people were making a long voyage to come to the well, it was so that the animals could immediately have a drink. And this particular trough, wow, it's almost a metre wide, and it just looks like a kind of a giant meteorite that's been hollowed out. I wonder how old that is. It looks prehistoric. I'm in the most stunningly, stunningly beautiful place. Like I said, there's no one around. It's on the edge of a kind of a terraced hill where you can see the rows of dry stone walls going upwards and upwards. There's olive trees all around and some very traditional houses up on the hill nearby, and then forest on the top. You wouldn't believe how hard it was to find the Po de Beni Musa. And I somehow feel that the Caminos of Ibiza set me this test as a kind of an initiation to really understand the theme of this episode, because I wasn't supposed to come here today. I was supposed to record this episode yesterday afternoon at about 5 o'clock, which is when I was pacing around nearby in the valley of Beni Musa, searching in vain for the well. At one point, I had a companion with me who will pop in towards the end of the episode, who was also helping me to find the well. And we asked locals. We were given strange instructions, which turned out to be completely misleading. We were sent to the wrong well, the Po de Beni Musa, which is another one on more of a main road. And at one point, I thought, maybe I have to just give up and record at the Podem Bennett, which is quite a familiar sight on the side of the road. Maybe the fact that there's cars driving by all the time, that could fit in with the theme of Caminos. But something willed us to keep searching, and a full moon appeared behind the forested hill by the time we were still onto something and thinking that we'd found the starting point to come and find the well. And under that same full moon, I started walking down the path which I just came down again today, and was frightened out of my wits by an Alsatian dog which turned out to be on a chain and harmless. And I could see the beginning of a path down into this orchard, and I sensed that the well was here, but it was just too dark, and I was a little concerned that I was stepping on private land. So, under the moon, I drove home. Just after I finished my journey, a little section of that moon just fuzzed out as the shape of the edge of the earth came into view on that eclipse evening. And this morning I have returned, feeling quite blessed by that little adventure. And sure enough, I continued down that path and I did find the Po de Beni Musa. So in the Inventory of Hydraulic Heritage of the Pitiusas Islands, a wonderful educational volume about all of the wells of Ibiza and Formentera, it states that the Po de Beni Musa, which I'm gazing at now, was first recorded in the year 1765. But as with all of these wells, there's no doubt that it or another version of it has been around for much, 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 much longer. There's a sad note in that book about this well. It says, "A great dance was always held there on St. Peter's Day, which stopped when the well dried up around the year 1950. That really, really struck me, and I found it incredibly sad, because these days most of Ibiza's wells are dry, and the Balpayes folk dance tradition has never been stronger. Yet in those days, somehow, if a well dried up, they took it as a sign to say that that well was no longer worth celebrating. It was no longer part of the island's folklore, which I find really tragic and sad. And I'm glad to say that they now do the dances here every summer, and they're on the first weekend after St. Peter's Day, so which is at the beginning of July, so they've reinitiated the tradition. So as I mentioned, I'm in the valley of Beni Musa, in the south of Ibiza. Beni Musa is one of the island's place names which truly represents its Moorish Arabic heritage. So Beni means son of, and Musa means Moses, so Beni Musa, the son of Moses. And apparently around the 14th century, which was just at the end of the Moorish rule on Ibiza, before the invasion of the Catalans, Beni Musa was the title of a huge Arabic farmstead, which basically spread across this valley, and it was one of the biggest of the island. And the legacy of that is still very, very clear. This is a valley which is filled with dry crops, as in crops which aren't watered by anything other than rainwater, carob trees, fig trees, almond and olive trees. Close by is the olive oil producer Duan Bennett, which is one of the main olive oil producers of Ibiza. And it's said that Beni Musa has always been fed by really, really healthy, strong underground aquifers, underground vaults of water, which, by the looks of the pomegranates in this orchard around me, is no doubt true. But it's also a very bittersweet fact, because I've also heard that the underground water supplies of Beni Musa have since been pumped to supply many of the most touristic parts of the island, such as the nearby resort of San Antonio, which again is very poignant that Beni Musa's ancient underground water supply is now feeding endless hotels, whilst the Po de Beni Musa, the well which is named after this ancient valley, has run out of water. So on a personal note, Beni Musa is where I spent my first winter on Ibiza when I moved here. I was living at La Casita Verde Ecological Centre, which is somewhere off behind me in the valley. And a few little memories I have of that winter. Beni Musa is the only place here where I once truly felt like I was lost as night was falling. I'd gone up a forested mountain following a path, remembering which path I needed to get down to get out, and somehow I just lost the point where that path began to get me back down again, just as the sun was set and the sky was darkening. And I ended up coming down the wrong side of the mountain, and that was one of the only times when I've truly, truly felt lost on Ibiza and wondered what would happen. And another memory I have of that Benimusa winter is that it was the first time that I encountered the haunting cry of the local owl, the Scops owl. So, as I sit here on this Sunday morning, talking to you, we're approaching Samhain, Halloween. Around here it would be called Tot Sants, the eve and the day of All Saints, the time of the thinning veil, the time perhaps when the separation between this realm and the underworld is thinner. So here, whilst any reputable nightclub venue wouldn't be seen dead without hosting some kind of Halloween party, here the true culture has always been about Tot Sants, All Saints Night. And there's a lovely piece of writing from 1976 by the Ibizan folklorist Joan Castillo Guash, who was also the person who collected most of the folktales of Ibiza and Formentera. And he wrote a piece which reminisced sadly on how, in the late 70s, so many of the Tot Sants traditions had already been lost. And he wrote, "No more the peasants with their baskets filled with pine nuts, acorns, pomegranates, persimmons, quinces and chestnuts, the fruits of the season and the fruits of the earth." And he adds that, sadly, chestnuts no longer grow on Ibiza in the late 70s, so people have to go and get them from Catalunya. And then this write-up gets quite humorous when Joan Castillo Guash reminisces about the local trick-or-treating traditions, which have nothing to do with the Halloween traditions that came from America, but curiously have a lot in common. So I've attempted to translate from Ibithenk the typical exchange which would take place between the young people going knocking on the doors of the houses to ask for treats and the inhabitants of those houses. And I've come up with something like this. And I've run it by a native and they seem to agree with me. So it goes as the following. Que ya res per ses animes? What will you spare for our wretched souls? Ni manco pels cosos. Nothing. And there won't be nothing for your wretched bodies either. Mal vos caigu el cul a trozos. May you fall so badly your ass breaks into tiny pieces. Y tú el repleguis a mozos. Then you can eat up all the pieces, mate. So, that's apparently a typical old Ibithenkan Tot Sants exchange, in case you hear it on the streets in the next couple of nights. But Joan Castillo Guash, the folklorist, reminisces most wistfully for what happened within the home on the eve of All Saints, a tradition which is known here as Satrencada, and it's being revived in recent years. So he describes that the family table would be laden with all of these seasonal delights, the quinces, the fruits, the nuts, candied fruits and little cakes made out of pine nuts and almonds. They would bake bread, they would light candles, there would be some sweet wine or coffee for the adults. And then he says that the elders, the grandparents, los abuelos, would go into their repertoire of stories and tales about witches, baruguets and familiars, which is the local little pixie spirits. And he said that everybody would listen with utter devotion, especially the children. Around midnight they would go to bed, but they would leave the candles lit and they would leave the table spread covered with food to welcome the ancestors to come and eat from the table. And then the next day the family would gather again in the morning and they would eat anything that was left over. So, my theme for this episode is Camino. The dirt roads, the red earth roads, those tracks and rights of way which were here way, way, way before tarmac and asphalt and cement. Some of these caminos now are accessible to car, and others aren't. Some have only ever been accessible to mules and carts. Now, before we dive into this, the word camino is funny etymological terrain because It's actually a word that's really hard to translate into English. A camino is generally smaller than a road, but bigger than a path. And perhaps I wonder that's why camino is one of those words which has been fully adopted from Spanish into the English language. So in the tales that I will share with you, I might sometimes be calling these tracks lanes, paths, roads, but mostly I will call them caminos. So to begin this journey down Ibiza's caminos, we need to be sure that we're attuned to the correct rhythm of the caminos. Caminos have their own rhythm, and it's one which is mirrored by the rhythms of my old battered 1986 Renault van, which only plays cassette tapes. Now, at the beginning of this year, a certain cassette tape fell into my hands. It was the new album of the Edinburgh-based musician, artist, illustrator Burnt Paw. His album Levitation Songs, which, to my delight, he announced would be available on cassette tape. This cassette...
The light pours through.
Whose side A and B probably last no more than about 15 minutes... has accompanied me along the twisting, turning, bumpy Camino of this year. And as I've listened to side A, side B, pressing the button that goes click to turn the tape over, and continuing, watching the landscapes shift, some familiar, some new, but all kind of blending into this ongoing familiar scenery of my life. I suppose for me it represents slow travel, transiting through time and truly embracing that slow transit. I remember the words somebody told me this year, a woman who grew up on the island, surrounded by these landscapes, and her father lived on top of a mountain, in a crumbling house without any electricity. And one thing that she really fondly remembered about her father was that every day when he drove her off the mountain, down the Camino, he would prepare his cassette tape in the car so that exactly the right song for the moment would play as they headed off down the Camino. Camino travel is slow travel. It's savored travel. So my first encounter with Ibiza's Caminos was on my first extended stay on Ibiza as a wide-eyed 20-year-old with my school friend Claire. And shortly after hitchhiking our way out of San Antonio, where we'd abandoned a package holiday, we found ourselves being driven up a mountain right in the northwest of the island to be offered overnight lodging by a well-meaning but scatty character who'd found us trying to sleep on some sun loungers on the beach an hour previously and just wanted to help us. I remember that first encounter with the Ibizan Camino. I remember the horror, the awe, the fear of those deep crevices opening up on the jagged, cratered red mud road in front of us, their black depths contrasting with the ridges and mounds that were illuminated by the headlights. It was impossible. How was he getting up this Camino? The man seemed to be sleepwalking, his Ford Fiesta chugging effortlessly up a red earth mountain face, hopping over deep gaping splits, each set of wheels miraculously seeming to weave from one narrow raised ledge to the next. It was as if the road was tearing into pieces. This teeny old square car just toddling over erratically shaped ridges in the compacted earth as though following a script, driving on autopilot. The underworld's black gaping mouth nipped us all the way up the mountain. So my friend Claire, with whom I had my first initiation into Ibiza's Caminos, returned to the island recently, and I thought I'd have a little conversation with her, because we really ventured into these Caminos together, mostly hitchhiking. And Claire was the creator of a very special tome, a booklet, which she made every single ride that we took. She would document who we'd hitched a lift with, the time of day, the location, and some little description or anecdote about the person. Sadly, I've never seen it since that year, which was half my life ago. And according to her, it was last sighted in a shoebox under her bed in Exeter. So a little while ago, we had a little chat about those days and about the mythical booklet, which I wonder whether I'll ever see again. So I'm in my studio and I have a very, very, very special person in my studio with me today, someone who's not been here for a very long time. It's my dear old friend, Claire Barton. Is it all right if I share your surname, Claire?
I think that's okay, Jo, yes. I'm pleased to be here. It's been a long time and I am sat in your studio. What a place it is. Lots of puppets are surrounding us. It's the middle of the day. And here we are, my first podcast, so be gentle with me.
It's an honour to have you on this podcast, Claire. You're a very important person in my story of getting to know Ibiza, as we're about to discuss a little bit more. So let's have a little rewind back to the year 2002, when we, to give a little summary of the year of 2002, am I correct in saying that we spent the first half of the year working very rubbish jobs in England?
Yeah, that's right. So I think some call centre work in the mix, maybe some working at a well-known supermarket for me. I think you might have gone off grid and done some sort of live-in care work to maximise the savings. But we knew that we were going somewhere and we were just sort of, you know, trying to save up as much money as possible for the summer that we didn't know was about to happen.
Precisely. And we ended up on a package holiday in San Antonio.
That we booked, just to set a bit of a scene here, via teletext. Yeah.
See, it's your attention to detail, Claire, that has always astounded me. These are things that I just don't remember. So we're at the Hotel Tagomago on a two-week package holiday booked through teletext. And, you know, we're talking about the Camino of life and basically the rites of passage experience that many people undertake in many, many different ways. for us, our two-week package holiday and how we veered off from it and ended up in the north of Ibiza for 3 months, that was our personal rites of passage, wasn't it? And so our two-week holiday came to an end in the Tago Mago, and what, we found ourselves kind of discarding our belongings, didn't we?
Yeah, starting with the plane tickets home. We sort of knew that actually we wanted to stay a bit longer and we didn't really know how. So I remember we had these massive, like, kind of unsuitable suitcases, really, that we just asked the friendly staff whether we could just leave them in reception. Packed a few things in a bag and, yeah, off we went.
So my memory that's clear in my head is that, well, first of all, let's set the facts. We had absolutely no idea what was going to unfold, did we?
No.
We truly had no idea, but we were following some kind of urge to go north.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. I mean, I remember us sort of looking at a map of Ibiza. In fact, I think I remember, you know, during the time of the kind of rubbishy jobs, I'm sure I remember you making this beautiful, intricate patchwork quilt. And in the middle was the shape of Ibiza.
It's true. It was kind of like a prophecy. Yes. So we took ourselves off to the roundabout on the edge of San Antonio. And I guess that at that point we realised, okay, we're going to do this. We need to get ourselves north. I don't really know how the idea of hitching had come into my head. I'd never done it. Neither of us had ever done it
buses,
before.
There just didn't seem to be any buses. I don't think that was even on our radar. There wasn't really much of a public transport system going on at that stage. I mean, you'd see taxis darting around here, there and everywhere. But yeah, it just seemed like the logical option, I guess. But also, I think we were pretty fearless, really, because, you know, there's a lot of traffic around San Antonio. We were kind of hitchhiking off a roundabout. Pretty fearless, I'd say, looking back, you know. But yeah, maybe it was a different time back then.
Yeah. And do you remember anything about how we got from the roundabout in San Antonio, which was kind of like our familiar ground, to the promised land of the north? Do you remember that journey? I just remember sticking my hand out, feeling very, very self-conscious, quite awkward, a little bit embarrassed, very, very exposed, you know, like the traffic of San Antonio staring at us, and not knowing whether anyone was going to pick us up.
Yeah, and not really knowing where we were going to end up that night. We just sort of trusted, I suppose, that we were going to get where we needed to go.
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember the details, but what I remember is that somebody, whoever it was, it's probably in the communal diary, which we will mention later, somebody picked us up, and I think that there were a series of different lifts because, you know, to get from San Antonio to Benirás is quite a complex, you know, you have to go to various different crossroads, don't you, and take different directions. But somehow that night we ended up, am I correct, on Benirás Beach.
Yes.
Now, for me, this kind of first maiden voyage to Benirás is quite significant because we started that voyage on an asphalt roundabout built for the mass tourism industry. And at the end of that night, we found ourselves going up a Camino, an earth-cracked Camino, which represented the opposite of all of that. So could you refresh our memory a little bit and say how we ended up going up in a kind of battered-out Ford Fiesta up a very dangerous-looking dirt road?
Well, yeah. I mean, we had arrived on Benirás and we felt like we'd found our beach, I suppose. Kind of didn't have a concept of how, you know, night would fall. We would need to work out what to do next. But yeah, we met a guy, we'll call him A, and, you know, we got talking to him and stuff, and I think we were going to end up laying our heads, you know, down on the beach. And he said, oh, you know, why don't you come back to my place? My twin boys aren't there at the moment. You know, maybe you could stay a night there. So we just sort of thought, yeah, great option. Let's do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's important to add at this stage as well, truly, you know, we're not stupid, either of us. I think we knew pretty clearly that this man genuinely had no ulterior motives. He genuinely had found two girls in their early 20s trying to sleep on sunbeds in an empty, quite breezy beach in the middle of the night, and he genuinely just wanted to help us. So the pretty amazing thing was that we got into his little battered car. Can't remember the exact model. I think it was a Ford Fiesta.
It was a red Ford of some sort, mm-hmm. yeah.
And, you know, through the dim light of his headlights, he just sort of went up the road that comes out of the Kala and turned off up one of these dirt tracks. And in my memory, you know, I don't know whether with the passing of time it just becomes exaggerated and ridiculous, but I just remember looking in sheer horror at the crevasses opening up in the road that we were driving up, quite a steep and windy yeah. road going into the mountain.
It was like the cars were not supposed to be on those roads. They were too dangerous for those cars. What the hell were we doing in a Ford Fiesta? You know, it felt like we could have fallen off a cliff at any point, really. But he seemed to know what he was doing and, you know, kept going until we got to the top, where we found ourselves on a boat on top of a mountain.
We still don't understand how the boat got on the top of the mountain, but yeah. So the summer continued, and basically, I mean, we were in quite an unusual situation because we had no real plan, but we were constantly on this sort of passage somewhere. Can you say a little bit, Claire, about, you know, the rhythm of those days, about how we would just end up being wherever it was that someone happened to bring us?
Yeah, so there wasn't really a plan. There was a map and there was some sort of communal diary where we'd sort of document what was happening, maybe in just one sentence, you know, of what we'd done that day. But, we'd maybe form a plan to get to some place, but actually when we got on the road and hitchhiked, we'd really be asking people where they were taking us. It wasn't really up to us. We just had to sort of trust that this compass was going to take us where we needed to be next, or the next part of our adventure or journey. And it was a bit of a slow rhythm of life, really. So you might have something in your mind about going somewhere in Ibiza, but actually pretty quickly you'd realise that that might not align, because whoever picks you up in their car may not be going there. And also, let's not forget, this was in a time where people didn't really have mobile phones. You know, time for journey was just different, I suppose.
I've got a memory of at some point we hitched a lift with a guy. I think it was in a soft top car, and I left my bag in the back of his car. And basically that dictated the next 2 days of what we did, because we had to go back down south to find the man who'd given us a lift without any mobile phone or anything like that. I think maybe we had his first name. I had to find my bag, and somehow I found it. But I can't remember how. I don't know what happened, but all I remember is that that dictated the next 2 days of what we did, and we ended up in the south just moving from place to place.
Yeah. Different times now, I think.
What do you think these people that gave us a lift, you know, why do you think they picked us up? What was in it for them?
I guess kindness, really. So I suppose a genuine kindness, maybe an intrigue. You know, our conversations would always start the same way, you know, but on name us, you know, like that would happen and then the rest would follow, really.
I also feel, now that I think about it, that those people... Maybe there's something that's kind of activated when you reach out for help. We live in such a separated society nowadays. And when you're driving by and you see someone, especially, you know, a young woman, let's face it, there is a kind of a gender thing at play here. You see someone requiring your help. It kind of activates maybe something which is dormant in us human beings, which is waiting to reach out and connect and really support somebody. Even if they happen to be a stranger, you know. Like, I often felt that, you know, there were always the cars that we knew were never going to stop for us. It was kind of like you could start reading the cars, couldn't you? That one, zoom, it's not going to stop. But then there was a particular character or type of person, and often it would correlate with a particular type of car as well. Lots of stickers, not clean, something broken, making a strange noise. Those cars would always, always stop. And it was just like this feeling of wonder in your heart when you saw it slow down and pull over. and you thought, who's this? Do we already know this person?
Have you been sort of picking up people when, as a driver and someone who lives now on the island?
Well, I've never quite seen two 20-year-old girls standing with loads of bags regularly at different points around the island. But every now and again, especially, you know, in the summerish months from about May to October, you'll get the occasional person. I must say that sometimes it's a lone guy, and for whatever reason, you do have to sort of check with yourself, does this feel okay? And occasionally it hasn't felt okay and I've driven on. But in other situations, you know, if you're able to stop, if you're not in a desperate mad rush, something kicks in and I just think, I have to do this. And that's I think part of a paying back of a debt. You know, all of those people who gave us lifts 20 years ago, I feel like I'm obliged to repay the favour to anyone who's trying to do that now. It's really, really important.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm. So do you look back on that summer as a summer which taught you something or gave you something?
Yeah, it did. It was a really amazing experience, really. Time sort of was a funny thing as well. It just felt like we had all the time in the world and that all these important things were happening, and we just sort of trusted everything about the island to look after us, really, you know. It was a very different era, and I suppose there's something also about that youngness, that youth, that kind of wide-eyedness about everything. And, yeah, it feels like it can never be repeated, really, for me. It was a one-off sort of experience that I won't forget. And, you know, those sort of documents I look back on, like the communal diary that we kept, where we'd write, you know, just one line, or, you know, what the moon was doing that night or something like that, you know, just can trigger all these memories, you know, to come back from just a line in a diary. Yeah.
Claire, where is the communal diary? I thought you were going to bring it with you.
Well, yes, the communal diary, I think, is somewhere in my dad's house in Devon, underneath the bed, under a lot of stuff. But I think the communal diary needs to come back to Ibiza. So here is on record, I will be giving the communal diary back to Jo, and she can probably make a whole podcast series about it.
Lots of love, Claire.
Straight back at you, kid.
So many of the first foreigners, non-Ibethans, who made their way down Ibiza's caminos were hippies on the overland route to India in the late 60s and early 70s. I think about the much, much greater pilgrimage that they were on, of which their time on Ibiza was often just a little brief stopover. And I feel that perhaps there's a little essence of that pilgrimage that they left in Ibiza's earth tracks. I quote from the introduction to a wonderful book, A Season in Heaven by David Thomery, which collects accounts from those overland travellers to India in the 60s and 70s. And in the introduction, he says, "I think we have to root the journey to the East that we made in the history we all carry with us, and in some kind of subliminal conception that there is a place that contains something promising and desirable, something that our own culture has somehow lost." And now I turn to the lyrics of a very well-known Joni Mitchell song, California, from an album that was released in 1971. Joni says, "So I bought me a ticket. I got on a plane to Spain. Went to a party down a red dirt road. There were lots of pretty people there, reading Rolling Stone, reading Vogue. They said, 'How long can you hang around?' I said, 'A week, maybe two. Just until my skin turns brown. Then I'm going home. To California.'" It's been oft said that Joni was referring to a brief stopover that she herself had on Ibiza and her own little encounter with those red earth caminos and the places that they led to. But way before all of that, before Ibiza's caminos were a road of discovery to seekers from distant lands, what have they always been to the natives? When I think about pre-tourism Ibiza, I see that labyrinth of closed caminos spread across the surface of this island as a kind of a sprawling mycelial network, bringing together this interconnected, interwoven community, a whole world of things that was absolutely invisible to the outer world, just like the mycelial network below the forest floor is invisible to a walker walking across it. So, on pre-tourism Ibiza, you could say that the central access points or hubs to all of these sprawling caminos were the places where the local people would come together to celebrate, to mourn, to grieve, to laugh, to say hello. Those places, those hubs, were, in previous times, the churches. In an article called All Roads Lead to Missa, which you can find on the Ibiza Tourist Board website, it says, in traditional Ibizan society, which until the onset of tourism had been rural and isolated over the course of many centuries, the church became a prime meeting point for the island's inhabitants. Many of them, in fact, would only leave their homestead once a year to celebrate their patron saint's day. Because of this, some of Ibiza's villages still preserve the traditional Caminos de Misa, or pathways to church, old rites of way generally crossing privately owned land but granting public access to churchgoers and also for the carros de mort, or the funeral carriages. On an island where there were barely any urban centres and Ibizenko's closest neighbours would often be located several kilometres away, these caminos linked rural houses to their nearest churches, granting them the quickest and most direct access to all of the significant events, baptisms, funerals, patron saint days. So now the article talks about a particular church, the Puig de Missa, which is this incredible, majestic, whitewashed, fortified church on a mount near the town of Santa Eulalia. And to this church, the Ibizenkos would have walked long distances from various directions heading off into the countryside. The final stretch of the old rites of way which lead to Puig de Missa have recently been restored. And today, walkers can revive one of the oldest traditions of the Ibizan countryside. At different points around the edge of the mount, there are sets of stone steps which lead straight up to the church. The location of each of these staircases coincides with the end of the corresponding Camino de Misa, the tracks which traditionally stretched in all directions into the countryside surrounding the church. So let's just be clear about this for a moment. In those times of rural isolation, as much as people would want to go and share their love for God, I have no doubt that above anything else, the church was a social meeting point to go and share your love for your fellow human beings, to have human contacts, to take part in a intergenerational community ritual, like those epic overnight shadow puppet plays in Indonesia where people don't even listen to what's happening, they chatter all the way through and go in and out. It's about coming together and being with your fellow community. So this idea of the isolated and rural society of pre-tourism Ibiza was really, really epitomised by the tiny village of San Vicente in the northeast of Ibiza. And in the book Ibiza, la destrucción del paraíso by Juan Luis Ferrer, the author describes San Vicente as the living image of an Ibizan Shangri-La, with a few scattered peasant houses completely disconnected from the rest of the world, arranged between mountains, and with the only point of reference being the nearby magnificent sandy beach, always empty. Via the tracks which meandered from San Vicente to the rest of the island, it was said that a full day was needed to take the journey by cart to Ibiza town. For the inhabitants of San Vicente, the island's main town would have been a distant fantasy world which many villagers had never ever seen. And in another piece about San Vicente written by the historian Emily Kaufman, she quotes an Ibizan historian, Juan Marie Cardona, as saying, "How these people were able to carve out a life in such inhospitable conditions is almost incomprehensible. It was like the end of the world. There was no road, just a terrible, rutted track from Sakala to San Juan." So in those days, you could say Ibiza was closed. It was shut. That mycelial network was packed tightly beneath the earth. But when we're talking about the caminos and what they represent, it's really important to ponder for a moment on what happened when tourism arrived. So again, from the book Ibiza, la destrucción del paraíso, there's a certain phrase which gives me the chills, which refers to what began to take place rapidly on the island from the early 60s onwards. Juan Luis Ferrer writes, "It was time to, in inverted commas, open up the island to tourism. This was a phrase which was repeated incessantly in the offices of builders, lawyers, politicians and media outlets across the island. Suddenly, the Ibithenka people realised that the landscapes, coves and beaches that the average tourist would come looking for were, in many cases, completely inaccessible by land. This was logical, because they had always been the most unproductive stretches of the island, and therefore had always been overlooked and forgotten. But now, proper roads needed to be built and asphalted at lightning speed. Pine trees needed to be felled, mountains cut through, in order to, in inverted commas, open up the island to tourism. And the author then quotes a local politician who gave a public talk around that time, saying, "Nothing can wait until tomorrow. Tomorrow could be too late. Ibiza at last is waking from its many hundred years of slumber." Now, someone who I quote in almost all of my episodes, and I'm going to do that again now, is Rolf Blackstad Sr., the now deceased founder of the local architecture company Blackstad, and more importantly to me, the poet, pagan, mystic, who I feel has always been very attuned with the essence of the island. In his writings about life on Ibiza in the 50s and 60s, Blackstad wrote, "Then I noticed that not all of the fruit was being collected. The less popular ones, such as prickly pears, quinces and loquats, sometimes even figs, were left to rot on the branch. No longer would you see men at the seashore harvesting seaweed by horse and cart for mending roofs. Nor did the fisherman stop his van at the crossroads to blow his conch shell announcing his wares to the farm women. Dirt roads were being covered in asphalt, causing long queues of summer beach traffic. The air permeated by the intense, pungent smell of hot tar." The American writer Carlos Castaneda, in his memoir The Teachings of Don Juan, about his apprenticeship with an Indian shaman, writes about paths, about caminos. He says, "Anything is one of a million paths. All paths are the same. They lead nowhere. Does this path have a heart? If it does, the path is good. If it doesn't, it is of no use. Both paths lead nowhere, but one has a heart, the other doesn't." So with this opening of Ibiza's mycelial network, opening of the island to tourism, came a change in rhythm, and came the building of the fast, speedy roads and the motorways. And if we're thinking about that world of life and story and heritage that's just beneath the surface of the earth, then I have to quote once again from Ibiza, La Destrucción del Paraíso, to talk about a certain piece of the island's ancient history which came to the surface whilst the motorways were being constructed at the beginning of this century. The writer says, "On the 22nd of December 2004, right in the middle of the construction of Ibiza Town's second ring road, excavators destroyed a Punic cistern, subterranean freshwater storage tank, which archaeologists estimate was in use until around the year 1000 AD. Carthaginians, Romans, Moors, over the course of many centuries, used and benefited from this same structure. It played a role in the lives of countless generations of humans. These people spoke different languages, revered different gods, feared different enemies, and all along the cistern stood the test of time. It was in active use for around 1,000 years, then fell into disuse for another 1,000 years, lying intact for future generations to discover. But it only took minutes for it to be reduced to a pile of rubble. The archaeologists working for the Abethan government, whose prime purpose was to facilitate the construction of the motorways, didn't consider the cistern worthy of conservation. So as an island opens up, becomes connected, accessible, convenient, efficient, simultaneously an island closes and shuts down. It closes from the inner paths, those paths which bind together human communities and preserve their stories, preserve their identity. And also with these new roads, this new rhythm, came new fences, barriers, separations, which often cut off the access to these ancient capillaries, the caminos. So in the Book of Trespass, Nick Hayes says, "There are boundaries in nature. There are rivers, there are forests, escarpments, ravines and mountain ranges. These are cellulose walls. But these boundaries are, in fact, areas of transaction, semi-permeable membranes. The notion that a perimeter should be impenetrable is a human concept alone." So let's fast forward to now, as All Saints' Eve comes close, and we find ourselves between two realms, the realm of the living, the realm of the dead. Well, in today's times, we find ourselves in that fluid realm, between the old and the new, between the old roads and the new ones, between the old rhythms and the new ones. And in the year 2018, an important thing happened. A local cultural association was formed called the Platform for the Indexing of Abetha's Public Caminos, and its aim was described as to promote the traditional caminos and paths of Abetha, and to defend their use in ways which foster respect and community cohesion. At the launch of this grassroots association, the founders said, "It's imperative to start this cataloguing process in order to define which caminos are accessible to the public, to name them, to map them, to determine their possible functions and uses, and thereby to be able to defend them as part of Abetha's shared cultural heritage." And with the creation of this little organisation came a significant change in consciousness, because that same year there was a small but very meaningful victory. Caminos which had been cordoned off, abandoned, placed under the possession of somebody else, were slowly beginning to be remembered, noticed and rescued. So in the local press in the year 2018, it was announced that the luxury five-star spa hotel Nashamena in the northwest of Abetha had been fined for fencing off 3 public rights of way, 3 caminos. They had been ordered to open them up again to the general public. The healing of the caminos had begun. So in September of 2023, last month in fact, something happened which I think took this healing journey of Abetha's caminos into completely new, unexplored territory. A previously abandoned camino near the village of Jesus in the south of the island was opened up, and its incredible vault of stories was made accessible to the general public through the power of theatre. Now, a while ago, I went and talked to one of the main figures who made this possible, theatre maker Thalia Ruith, and the voiceover has been kindly given to me by Karen Colleen, who's an artist, activist and founder of Extinction Rebellion Abetha.
Bueno, es un sábado por la mañana y estoy en una esquina de la Iglesia de San Miguel.
So it's a Saturday morning and I'm in a little corner of the porch of the Church of San Miguel, surrounded by some particularly lush leafy plants, and sitting beside me is Thalia Ruith. Hey Thalia, how are you doing?
Pues muy bien, aquí estamos con...
Good, thanks. Yes, here we are, beside all these plants, which I'm sure will transmit a lot of information to us to help us as we go along.
Seguro que nos ayudarán. A ver, ¿cómo describirte, Celia? ¿Eres clown?
I'm sure they will. So, how to describe you, Celia? You're a clown? From what I can gather, you're a theatre director, a theatre maker. You also work a lot with object theatre. Is there anything else I can add to that?
Bueno, yo trabajo desde siempre la creación haciendo...
Well, from the very beginning, my creative work has been about what I call haciendo las almas visibles, or making souls visible, because the work is quite deep. It's about moving from the exterior towards the interior, always with the aim that the soul is involved with the creative process. So all my work is very concerned with the poetic and liminal realm, with the evocative, the transcendental, and yeah, that forms the basis for everything that I do. I work with sensory theatre, object theatre. Clowning has been very central to my work because I found that it allowed me to dive very deeply into all of this. It's the world of play where everything is possible.
Este tipo de universos más fácilmente, ¿no? Es como el niño o la niña creando, ¿no? Y todo vale ahí. Utilizo el objeto como medio de poesía. Utilizamos siempre el objeto que tiene una historia.
I use the object as a poetical medium. I work with objects which have a story to tell, which have their own memory. So by connecting with an object which has its own weight, solidity, memory, you're able to have a kind of conversation which leads to the creation of your performance. When I discovered this world, it was like, wow, yes, this is it.
Entonces esto, pues a mí me pareció una maravilla, ¿no? Esto para mí fue como, wow, encontrado ya, ya está. Ya lo tengo.
Y tengo la sensación de que ahora estamos acercando al tema del proyecto que quería hablar contigo.
So now I feel like we're edging towards the big theme which I came here to talk to you about. A project which I guess uses a physical place or territory as an object with its own memory. So how did it come about that you ended up applying this work that you've been developing over the years to a theatre project relating to an abandoned camino in the Ibithan village of Jesús?
Bueno, en un principio, a ver, yo empecé a trabajar mucho con el tema de los laberintos.
In the beginning, we were talking about the possibility of creating a labyrinth, but on a logistical level, this is pretty complicated. And the local community group, Jesús en Transición, were always saying to me, like, right, how are we going to get this going? At some point, they began to mention that in Jesús, there was a camino which had its own memory, its own particular story. And so it was like, wow, we could do this work here. Because when you're carrying out this kind of work, you always need something that hooks you in. A story, a memory, a kind of anthropological starting point. Some human characters, some souls who we can connect with. A story that makes us feel something, which is basically always the objective.
Y bueno, ellos me dijeron, mira, está este camino donde... vinculaba Jesús con Vila.
So, the group took me to this camino, which basically used to connect the village of Jesús with Ibiza town, or Vila, as it's called. And it was along this track that people from all over the island would come in order to work at the properties here, in Ibiza town, working directly for the landowners. And the people who came to work these plots of land were called, in Ibicenc, els mayorals, the tenant farmers. These workers, who were mostly men, maintained the properties and the land surrounding them. This included crops and also cattle, because in those days there used to be cows on Ibiza, something that I was really surprised to find out. So, by this point, I knew we had our material. We had what we needed in order to access a memory and a whole vault of emotion that connected to that memory.
Entonces quedé con Joan Costa, que él es antropólogo.
So, then I met with Joan Costa, the Ibizan anthropologist, who has an incredibly specialised knowledge on the anthropology of Ibiza, on how the island's rural land was divided up, and on this whole cyclical migration by which the tenant farmers would come down from San Juan, San Miguel and San Carlos in the north, and up from San Jose in the south to this territory. The work cycle would start and end on the Dia de San Juan, St. John's Day, in midsummer. And it would run through the winter and finish the following midsummer. When I heard all of this, it was like, wow, this is amazing. These workers came down with their families. It was a kind of internal mass migration that took place on the island. The tenant farmers looked after the properties and the land, and they'd harvest any produce and sell it themselves, unless the landowners did, but it was usually the tenant farmers who did it.
Entonces me parecía una figura que prácticamente no se conocía en la isla y era muy importante.
So this seemed to be a sector of society that was virtually unacknowledged, but incredibly important. These people were basically sustaining the island's population, and what's more, they were invisible. So what we wanted was to give them visibility. The women, meanwhile, took it upon themselves to maintain the facies, the irrigation channels running across the territory, which had originally been created by the Moors. These people would clear the channels, dig the earth, cut the brambles, all that kind of thing, to make sure that the waters kept flowing and kept feeding all this agricultural land. So to me, the role of the women became clear. They tended to the waters. They irrigated, fed and maintained these terrains. In our final performance, we represented this female archetype with a character called the lavandera, the washerwoman. And she is very similar to what I see as the archetypal woman of Ibiza, the figure who is constantly sustaining, maintaining, supporting everything around her, the family, the home, the business. And she is also invisible. And these women are incredibly potent and powerful, with a deep intelligence and a profound understanding about sustainability and self-sufficiency.
Y luego en este camino estaban también las oradoras, que son las mujeres que mantenían la iglesia.
And the other people who used this camino were the women we called the oradoras. These were the cheerful singing women making their way to mass at the church. Ibiza's churches are beautiful architectural sites, like the ones we're sitting in now. They were a primary social meeting point for the inhabitants. So in our project, we wanted to pay homage to the women going to church, a routine, an act which brought the entire village community together. At this stage in the performance journey, when the public encountered this character, a certain ritual would happen to connect the journey taking place along the Camino with the personal journey of the participant, the audience member, because our aim was always to unite those two strands.
Wow. Es como que no tengo que preguntarte nada, yeah. Solo puedes contarme. Yeah.
Wow. It's like, I just don't have to ask you a single question here, Celia. I'm just silently taking this all in, completely gobsmacked. So what did you and the team discover or feel regarding the personal journey of these characters?
Bueno, uf. Es que fue muy potente, como cada proyecto que se abre desde este lugar.
Well, it's so, so potent. Whenever you do a project of this type, it becomes something very soulful, very ancestral. It's like there's a kind of catharsis that takes place. Anyway, there's a pretty crazy anecdote I can tell you. One day, we went and visited the cemetery because many of the people that Joan Costa had told me about were buried there, in the cemetery of Jesus. So basically, I wanted to go there and to ask permission to carry out this work. The whole team came with me to the cemetery, and it was a way of paying our respects above anything else. Because we understood that we were working from that place, from a very soulful place, opening up a kind of constellation, bringing back these souls into the here and now. And we felt this. We felt this was happening on many different levels.
Bien, ese día, okay, fuimos, hicimos una pequeña visita.
So anyway, we made our visit, we asked permission, we thanked them for being present because we felt their presence very strongly, and then we left. But as we left, at nightfall, I couldn't find my car keys, and I had to go back to the graveyard to look for them. And I really felt that as the leader, the guide of the project, these souls had wanted me to come back on my own. And I spent some time there, sat in the cemetery. And that was when I really felt their presence. I received a lot of information from them.
Que yo me sentase y realmente... Y allí, en este momento, yo recibí mucha información. Y al día siguiente, se pone en contacto una mujer, Fina, conmigo.
And the next day, a local woman called Fina got in touch with me. She said, my father died 4 months ago, and I've heard about the work that you're doing, and I'd really like to come and see it. So I got in touch with Juan Costa, and he told me that he knew this woman and her family, all of whom came to the performance, and he told me, I have a lot of audio recordings of Fina's father. So that crazy encounter led me to being able to introduce sound installations into the performance along the route. Recordings not only of Fina's father, but also of many other characters who Juan had interviewed 2 years previously when he carried out his research. And it was so powerful to hear the voices of these souls along the route. It was very magical. This work is just very magical.
Wow. Entonces, es como que las almas individuales estaban presentes.
I don't doubt it for a second. Wow. So it was like those individual real people were present.
Sí, de hecho, cuando yo empecé a crear qué habitantes iban a habitar.
Yes. In fact, when I was deciding which characters were really going to inhabit the performance with the help of Juan's research documents, it all seemed so clear to me. It was the tenant farmer, the washerwoman, the oradoras, the singing women walking to church, the mother, and the child. Oh, wait, I almost forgot about one more character, a very important one, the mujer agrietada, the cracked woman. And she was the figure who opened up the route at the start. We had a phrase which we used as a framework for the performance, which was the memory that's impregnated in the stones.
Este camino está limitado por un muro de piedra que es muy típico aquí en Ibiza.
You see, this camino, like so many on Ibiza, is surrounded on both sides by dry stone walls. And we needed some kind of symbol that the traveler, the participant, could connect with in order to access their poetic memory. So I chose the stone as that symbol. I came to realize that so much story, so much history is contained within stone. And how I saw it was that these stories found their way out through the cracks in the stone. That's how the character of the cracked woman came about. She received the travelers as they started their journey and communicated to them the idea that this story, this path, was broken and cracked, and that she was trying to put the pieces back together again. So that when we invited participants to help put this story back together again via old photographs which were broken up into pieces and had to be joined together again. So through this poetical exercise, the audience members began to understand metaphorically what the journey was really about. And that it was about piecing together the broken story of the Camino and at the same time piecing together some other story within themselves.
Entonces, a partir de ahí, el viajero entra en el camino y se encuentra con el mayoral.
So from there, the traveler continued down the route and encountered the tenant farmer, the man who is getting on with his farming tasks, he's mending the stone wall, he's gathering up almonds that have fallen from a tree nearby, and he invites the participant to have a kind of sensory encounter with the stone. I mean, this is a gentle invitation, it's not an obligation. Again, it's just a playful, poetic exercise. And we were thinking a lot about how to structure this invitation. Should the participant close their eyes, etc., etc.? And actually, the answer ended up coming very easily. We realized that the human body, when it comes close to a stone, has this instinctive response to reach out and touch it. There's a kind of ancestral memory in us, so that we know that stone contains information in it.
Hay como esta memoria ancestral de saber que en la piedra hay historia. Y ahí el mayoral invitaba a contar, a que simplemente el viajero pudiese expresar lo que esa piedra le abría.
And at this point, the land tenant character simply asked the traveler to express whatever thoughts or feeling the stone in their hands provoked to them. And curiously enough, pretty much all of the participants were transported to their childhood, to their own personal memory. So we gave each traveler space for this little moment with the stone. And then the land tenant invited them to choose a stone to take with them for the rest of their journey. So the idea was that from now on, the walker was not just encountering the historical story of the Camino, but another personal story unfolding within themselves.
Entonces ahí, después del mayoral, bueno, pusimos...
Anyway, from there, after meeting the tenant farmer, the travelers would go through various poetic installations. They encountered handwritten letters, other artifacts, and when they would arrive at the oradora characters, where there was a kind of unburdening or letting go of the weight that each walker, each traveler carries on their personal path. And there, we developed a certain ritual with the women. These figures were traditionally very joyful. Juan Costa had told us, no, don't believe for a second that these women were melancholy just because they went around dressed in black and shied away from the limelight. No, these women were cheerful. They often sang. And when I said they used to sing, what kind of songs used they sing? Juan told me, you have to meet Margalida. So, Margalida is a local woman who sings songs which tell stories. Stories about local gossip, what happened between different households. You know, Maria fell in love with Juan, but Juan didn't love her back. That kind of thing. It was all in these songs, which had no music. They were just sung with a naked voice in the way that is traditional here.
Okay, me voy a buscar a Margalida. Y Margalida me da un CD suyo.
So I go to find Margalida, and she gives me a CD of hers that was recorded a while back, and that was how we got hold of these songs which the oradora characters sing. So, they're very playful and cheeky, these women, and that is how we get the travelers to unload that burden they've been carrying from a place of playfulness. And then the audience continues on to the washerwoman. And she's inside an installation that consists of many white sheets hung up on lines, because, of course, this is a typical sight in Ibiza. And there's a scent of the laundry soap, because in sensory theatre, smells are so important. And now this woman invites the traveller to spin the yarn of their personal family tree, which is another poetical exercise based on the idea of wool spinning, which of course took place in past times. So, as the washerwoman spins the yarn, the traveller recounts their genealogical family tree, their ancestral line.
La importancia de la memoria del genealógico. Y ahí es cuando, wow, la gente, ¿no? De ahí salían muy, bueno, con todos sus ancestros muy presentes.
And wow, that was when, wow, the audience members were really hit by the experience. Suddenly they felt like their own ancestors were right there, walking next to them. And that's the point where the mother character tries to instill in them the importance of remembering where we come from, the importance of our own individual vault of memory. The traveller continues onward, and they arrive at the child character playing hopscotch on the path. And the child invites the traveller to join in with them. And that's when everything kind of lands. Through this playful little moment, we wanted the traveller to sense that actually this Camino, this journey, has no end.
Y que realmente ningún camino empieza. simplemente que mantenerlos vivos.
And actually, the camino has no beginning either. All we have to do is keep the journey alive. So, as the route came to an end, it felt like something was closing but also opening. The participants left with a feeling of openness, not pain, because sometimes when we're invited to look back into the past, we end up in a place of melancholy, of loss. But our intention was to evoke the opposite. We wanted to say, you can go back, but it can be joyful. The celebration of memory can be joyful. Because often, our memory carries a heavy weight. We tend to remember things that are incredibly painful, which involves suffering. The grandfather who fought in the war, the grandmother who died of famine. But there was also a lot of joy, of wonder and creativity.
Mi sensación en lo que me estás contando es que al final estos caminos viejos, abandonados, pero en este caso restaurados, están vivos. Ya está.
The feeling I have as you tell me all of this is that these old abandoned roads, or in this case no longer abandoned, that they're alive. It's that simple. They are alive. Even though Ibiza is now threaded with motorways, these old caminos have life in them for whoever wishes to come and find it.
Sí, sí. De hecho, cuando íbamos a hacer los ensayos...
Yeah. In fact, when we started going to the Camino for our rehearsals, the government of Santa Eularia arranged for the fire brigade to clear the track for us, because until then it had been impossible. And the moment the track had been opened up, coincidentally, we were there at that time, bringing some things down to the route. As we walked down the track, we came across two people. We were like, how did you know about this Camino? It was an English girl and an Italian guy. They were tourists.
Ah, no, es que hemos visto este camino y es una maravilla este camino.
And they told us, well, we saw this track and we just wanted to come down it. It's so special. And it leads straight to Ibiza town, right? So I told them, yeah, it links Jesús with Ibiza town. You end up on the Avenida 8 de Agosto. And they said, ah, it's so wonderful. So it's as if the moment you open the track, that's it. It doesn't need a signpost. It doesn't need some flashy placard saying this is the Camino or whatever. It's like these caminos call out to people. It's not that they're no longer needed or noticed or valid. No, they call out to people. We saw it that clearly that day and the people came.
Porque supongo que tocan a algo en nuestros instintos.
Because I suppose they call out to us on some instinctual level. We follow, we look for those tracks because of some kind of impulse that comes from within us.
Exacto, exacto. Mira, yo siento que como humanos, como humanas, necesitamos o deseamos recorrer caminos porque es la búsqueda. Es el principio del laberinto.
Exactly. I feel that we, as human beings, need or desire to walk these caminos because they represent the eternal search.
Where the dancers
I've been on this road so long, I'll tell you how it goes. Stones and dust you leave behind, and with every step and the way unwinds, blood and bones is what you'll find, the bones that break and the blood that binds. I've been on this road so long, I'll tell you how it goes. I've been on this road so long, it's growing over me. Those words are taken from the poem Road by Jessica Dunlop, who is also known as the Ibethan heritage wheat farmer Campurte. So at the Poda Benimusa, there's still not a soul. The shadow has crept bigger. Where I am, leaning against a stone wall, there's a distant sound of someone probably running their tractor over a field somewhere to my left. And I'm thinking about whether I can take some of those pomegranates back with me. I haven't come across a single human being since I arrived here today, but I've seen photos of the Balpayes well dances that take place here shortly after the Saint's Day of San Pere. And this little orchard is full of people. After nightfall, there's wine, there's local food specialities, there's music, there's dancing. But today, all that there is the birds, the butterflies, and a distant tractor. So, in July of this year, a really, really terrible thing happened very close to where I am, in the valley of Benimusa. A local Ibithencan cyclist and a well-known sportsman from the local community, a 49-year-old man called Bernat Ribas, was cycling along the Camí de Benimusa, which is the road which I took to come to this well. And it's a road that weaves through this valley, which is very popular with cyclists because of its quietness and the beauty of the rural landscapes. So on that day in July, Bernat was killed by a 4x4 jeep driving erratically, dangerously fast down the tiny Camí de Benimusa. The jeep didn't stop, and the cyclist was killed on the side of the road. The driver later handed themselves in, and local media suspects that he had probably consumed drugs or been over the limit of alcohol, because unfortunately these days on Ibiza it's not unheard of for drivers who commit crimes whilst driving to hand themselves in at least 12 hours later so that whatever substances they've ingested will no longer be recognisable in the tests. Now, things like this have happened before, but this time the local community was absolutely up in arms with grief and rage. It was one too many. The death of Bernat Ribas symbolised the clashing collision between the old roads and the new roads of Ibiza, the old rhythms and the new rhythms. The local community demanded change and demanded recognition that for two completely different, incompatible rhythms to share one tiny landmass means that cyclists and road users do not feel safe. So I'd like to add that on my way here this morning, a Sunday morning, pretty much the only other traffic on the winding caminos coming into the valley of Benimusa were cyclists, and they were mostly guys, young guys, and they just looked so happy. They just seemed so incredibly happy and peaceful. So maybe this episode has been about honouring the soul of these caminos, acknowledging the fact that they are alive, they are chattering, babbling, laughing, crying, teeming with all of the life that a human being could ever have within them. So, in the spirit of Todos Santos, I wanted to have a little chat before the end of this episode with somebody who continues to enjoy the Camí de Benimusa as a cyclist, somebody for whom this Camino plays a really important part in their personal and creative and professional life. So as a kind of a living guardian of the Camí de Benimusa, I wanted to have a little chat with Romany Sanchez, who simultaneously passes along the Camí de Benimusa many, many times throughout the year on her bicycle to get to her job as a firewoman working for the forestry management services of the island. But simultaneously, this Camino and all that it reveals to her inspires her incredible artistic life as a painter. So, Romani, hi. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Where are we?
We're actually on the Camí de Sa Capelleta, near a beautiful old ruin, and it's been cleared around it, and there's beautiful old stonework showing up, and it's a lovely sunny evening at the end of October, and it feels almost like September.
Yeah, it's a special evening, and we just had an interesting hour, didn't we? Would you care to expand?
Well, we were chasing the Pou de Benimusa because none of us knows where it is, and we were chasing it after a pin that was on the Ayuntamiento de San José, and it took us to a point at the road just below where we are, and really we couldn't find any Pou nearby, and we asked a neighbour and she sent us all the way to Benet, Boulder's Benet, which is the one I thought we were going to speak at, but so we haven't found it yet. I have another idea of where it could be, but we might ask some expert about where it is, somebody from the village.
It seems kind of fitting for this episode that I haven't yet found the well that I'm supposed to be recording at. Firstly, because it's kind of Todos Santos, so I feel like the spirits are playing tricks with us. And secondly, because of the theme of caminos and labyrinths, and truly over the past hour, I just feel like we've been through a weird labyrinth.
Yeah, because we divided ourselves and went different ways, and I was on my bicycle and I went up another trail and found a beautiful valley that I had never been up, and found a beautiful old olive tree, and it was really well kept. And yeah, there's always little corners to discover in Ibiza. It's incredible. This is what I love about the little trails and the caminos, and this is why I like exploring. I mean, I've been brought up here and I never cease to keep on finding new ways, new connecting, I call them caminos, even when I speak English. So it's, I guess they're dirt tracks or tracks, but I use the Ibicinco, the Spanish word, always. And I found myself using it in England as well, when I live in other places and they don't understand me, but that's what we call it, a camino.
Why do you think we all use the Spanish or Catalan term?
I don't really know. It's been passed down to me by my mother, I think. I mean, my mother never says a track. She'll always say camino. I guess because we live on caminos. And there was never Google Maps before or anything like that. People would always give directions to get to these little houses that are, you know, everywhere around in the countryside. Like you turn left on the little blue stone and then you go up the next by the big tree with the with the dipping branch, and you know, you'd always have these indications that are usually more accurate than Google, because what I find now is Google doesn't really tell you the right way up, because you keep losing contact with internet, which is great.
There are many ways in which, there are many caminos I could take in talking to you about caminos, Romani, but a main thing that I wanted to ask you about was, because this episode has been set in Benimusa, I I'm returning to the theme of Benimusa, which this episode started with, and I kind of see you as like a guardian of the Camino of Benimusa. Motorcyclista speeding along.
Making new trails,
finding their way through the labyrinth. So I see you as a kind of a guardian or a living soul of the Camino de Benimusa, because we've talked about the tragic thing that took place on that Camino earlier this year. And I'd really love to celebrate the spirit of it as this episode ends. And I thought there was no more perfect person to ask than you, who are very familiar with the Camino of Benimusa.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, Benimusa has kind of been like the valley in between all the places that I have lived as I've grown up. And then life took me to live in San Antonio area, which I didn't choose, but I made the best of it. And I also work on the other side, which is near the Bomberos, which is Tacoma. And so Benimusa is in the middle of my spaces where I move. And I really have a strong relationship with it, with the valley, with the different parts. And I cycle to, I try and not use my car as much as possible. And I love cycling. And I've, for the last few years, I've made it a thing where I always cycle to work. It takes me about 50 minutes to get to from my house there. I'm not a fast cycler, but I love the trail, and it's like I have a relationship with the trail, and I take different routes sometimes. It's not always the same one, but it's my, I think paths and caminos are actually, they're public, and it's my way that I can actually, they're nobody's, they're everybody's, and they're nobody's. There's not a private property. It's everybody can go through them, and so the experience of going through these little tiny caminos is really, it's, I cherish it so much because I don't live in the countryside anymore. I was brought up in the countryside. The countryside is now belongs to the multimillionaires or the Ibisinkos who haven't sold their property, and it's totally out of reach for anybody normal. So I was brought up integrated in the countryside, in a house where the countryside comes in the house and it's part of the outside, like a finca. And houses are not made like that anymore. They're made like with a terrace, and there's a limit, and there's a parking, and there's a... So I find that the countryside is my garden, the woods. And I work in the woods as well, which is my other... I love my job. And so I find that when I take my trail from where I live now, which is in a barrio, which in English would be
a neighborhood,
suburban neighborhood. I don't like living so close to other people, but I've found a nice way to live that way. And really, I need my trails to work and from, and my excursions out on the bicycle and walking, because it gives me the information that I need of how the seasons are changing little by little, all the details. And as I am cycling the same route, it keeps changing. And I'm sort of in tune with the weather patterns, with the time of the year, the little details that come, what nature offers me on the way. So I really, it's very special for me. And you make a little relationship with the sort of the stone that you always go past, and it looks a certain shape. And somehow I was thinking about something as I went past a certain tree. And every time I go past that tree, that same thought is sort of woven into that tree. And so I keep the path speaks back to me with my own thoughts that have been woven into the images that I've seen as I go by. So there's a very, very profound relationship, especially with the Camino de Benimusa, because it's where I cycle most. But there are many trails in Ibiza that I feel very connected to, and places where I've spent a long time working in the woods. You get to know every little bump and bush and way that the pine tree turns and every branch, and it's wonderful.
I suppose it's so simple, isn't it, that repetition, going along a route time and time and time again, that is how you create a relationship with something.
Exactly.
You begin to know it, and then you see something else new about it, and then you see something else new about it, and it begins to know you, so it kind of gives you back who you are. You find yourself along that route.
Yeah, I found myself sometimes saying... mi camino, like my path, And I think, no, it's not mine. It's not mine, but it feels like mine because the experience that I keep weaving into it is mine. And I am somebody who loves routes and labyrinths and maps. And I love, like in other places in the world where I've lived, I also sort of make a map of the place that I go to. And my memories are always woven into the places that I live and the paths, and I love walking through the paths again years later and receiving the information that I left there somehow. And it's a way of communicating.
And I think these caminos remind us of the journey of life, you know, that we're on a journey somewhere, which to me, that simple fact is in itself completely magical.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, I think I understand life as a labyrinth. Paths are, in my mind, are like a labyrinth, like the branches of a tree. And you take decisions and you go this way, or life makes the decisions for you and you take this path and that path, and you look back on it and you can see sort of like a root of memories that have been woven into. I think when I was very young, I was about 20 and I was living in the States, a shamanic woman that I was encountering, she's from the Cherokee tribe, and we did a dream circle, and she said to me, it came up that I was a spider, and I thought, I wanted to be something very sweet and cozy, like, you know, and I didn't like the idea of being a spider. And she said that you're like a spider web creator, and I didn't really understand, and it's kept coming back to me over the years, many years, in many ways, that yes, I do like connecting paths, weaving in things. And so I guess there is a bit of a spider in me. And yeah, I've worked on that idea.
Wow. Well, yeah, I feel like this is a wonderful place to be around Todd Sands, this kind of in-between place, you know, where in this valley, which is between one place and another, sort of like buried, lost, filled with meandering strange tracks and a well that we haven't quite been able to find yet.
We might be looking for a well and we find something else more interesting on the way. You know, I love that idea of setting out for something but not being fixed completely on it and being able to improvise and to welcome what comes when you're looking for what you think you're looking for, but something you really need comes along more.
I think that that's a wonderful sentiment, and I almost think we should toast it with some of your hierbas. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
I buy the anise from this place in Ibiza that makes them, and I around San Juan I get the herbs and I do them. And for the last few years, I have been making a special kind of hierbas where I use almost all St. John's wood, and they become red. And I started them for somebody who was having some depression issues, and I made it as a Christmas present, and some other friends tried it and they really loved it. And since then I keep making these every year as well, apart from the normal hierbas. So I thought I'd bring them today to share with you a new taste.
Wow. To the Caminos. Anything?
And full moon today, I think.
Caminos and full moon eclipse.
Yes.
Cheers. Oh my goodness, that is absolutely delicious. So we've talked about the old roads, the new roads, the dirt roads, the asphalt roads, the well-travelled roads, the less-travelled roads, the roads which open, the roads which close, the roads which have a heart, the roads which have no heart. But perhaps in the end, the message of all of these roads is the same. Perhaps arriving somewhere was never, ever the point. If all we're trying to do is get somewhere in a hurry, then maybe it's simple. Maybe we're on the wrong camino. I'm going to leave you with the words of the poet David White from his poem Santiago, which was inspired by the experience of his niece walking the Camino de Santiago, and it can be found in his book of poetry called Pilgrim, published in 2013. As if all along You had thought the endpoint might be a city, with golden towers and cheering crowds, and turning the corner at what you thought was the end of the road, you found just a simple reflection and a clear revelation beneath the face looking back, and beneath it another invitation, all in one glimpse, like a person and a place you had sought forever, like a broad field of freedom that beckoned you beyond, like another life, and the road still stretching on.
Despediguen com si ho fos de revista i pegues per altre vent a percurar-te alegria.
You've been listening to The Wells of Tanit, created by me, Joanna Ruby. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please help to spread the word and leave us a review on iTunes, as this really helps the podcast to be found by more people. The theme music is the song De Joed Vas Despedient by the Ibethan folk group Uk, released by Producciones Blau.
Seguiré lo mateix, visquent amb molta alegria. I aconhortat després de lo que mos pervendria, i en sé que no et sé ni et veig, que això et content algun dia. Per això no t'abandon i has de pensar que t'oblidi, que dins mon cor repeteix lo que em deies aquell dia. Sempre t'apreciaré i on se fuia que sigues, només per dar-te entenent que de tu estic agraïda.